The following podcast is sponsored by SuperheroStuff.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this edition of H2O. Jason Hunt here, sitting across from Timothy Harvey.
Hello.
And tonight we are going to discuss the legacy of Leonard Nimoy. And a lot has been said, a lot has been written over the weekend about Nimoy and his history. Excuse me, the impact that he's made on pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Not only as Mr. Spock, certainly was his biggest claim to fame, but in his other endeavors, both as a director, as a theater actor, as a teacher, as a poet, as a photographer, maybe not so much as a singer. But
I don't know. Come on.
Yeah, I have somewhere in my collection of cassette tapes. I have a
for the kids at home, a cassette tape.
They may be coming back. Still have a player.
Yeah, see, the return of vinyl makes a certain amount of sense. The return of the cassette tape is a little pointless.
But anyway, I have a cassette tape, and on that cassette tape is Leonard Nimoy singing If I Had a Hammer. And I think, if I remember right, I'd have to pull it out of the case, I think it also has William Shatner doing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Oh, of course it would.
It's one of these collections of, you know, these compilation tapes.
Sure.
That, you know, made its way around in the 80s. They were very popular, you know, all the hits of something, 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 you know, those
right.
things. But, but Leonard Nimoy, of course, you know, it's kind of, what do you say? I mean, John Scalzi posted on Twitter, he said, for everybody who's not understanding this, every geek just lost the grandfather.
Yeah.
You know, grandpa is dead. And then it struck me. Leonard Nimoy is 83 years old.
Yeah.
Now, William Shatner is also 83. Mm-hmm. They're only 4 days apart.
Right.
My dad is only 10 years younger. My dad's 73 this year.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be 74 in September. So for me, for my generation, Nimoy wasn't really necessarily the grandfather. He was my father's generation.
Yeah, well, we grew up with him. We grew
did.
Up. There were a couple of generations that grew up with Mr. Spock. And if you think about, actually, I'm going to go ahead and say there were three. There was our parents' generation.
Yes.
Watching the show live, when it was first on the air. Then there was us. You know, having that, being exposed to that as kids, and having the explosion of Star Trek: The Motion Picture, of Wrath of Khan.
I would say there's a generation in between, because you had those college age guys, the college group,
mm-hmm.
that were the first ones to find them in syndication when they came out in the early 70s, and you know, 70,
okay, sure,
72,
sure,
73.
Okay.
So maybe a half a generation there.
Yeah,
would that be?
But then you have Star Trek: The Next Generation, and an explosion of popularity.
Right.
And honestly, you could take that all the way up to the folks, because we know they're out there, whether we are necessarily huge fans of them or not. But the folks who became fans of Star Trek because of the new movies,
mm-hmm.
where there's Leonard Nimoy again.
Yeah.
And I think that if for all the flaws of the new movies, one thing that added weight to it was bringing in Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah,
you actually had that. You had the link, and that, and for whatever unhappiness some of the older fans may or may not have with the new movies, one thing that you end up having there is the nod from the creators of the new movies, mm-hmm. to look at the fans of everything else and say, it's all still there.
Right.
Right. This is just a new thing. All Leonard. Here's Spock. Here's the real Spock, and he's saying,
it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
And I think that would...
Well, and I think one thing that added weight to that is the fact that over the years, especially as Roddenberry's health was in decline,
mm-hmm.
toward Star Trek V, Star Trek VI, Nimoy was the one who seemed to have the most care and concern over the whole legacy and the integrity of what Star Trek really was about.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think Shatner, being the star, would be the one that would be out there to champion, okay, no, this is what the show is, and this is what we're supposed to be about, and all that. But it was actually Nimoy who really, you know, took the creative initiative on mm-hmm. a lot of that. I mean, he was the one that was coming up with a lot of the stories. He was a producer. He was an executive producer. He basically took the reins from Gene Roddenberry for a while. And I think that probably adds to, at least from a fan perspective, that adds to the credit, I don't want to say credibility, of the reboots. Because Nimoy took ownership mm-hmm. of Star Trek in a way that Bill Shatner did not. And that's from decades ago.
Oh, sure. Well, I think you know, and in some respects, I think, in all fairness to William Shatner, we have this expectation somehow. And I've been thinking about this a lot, actually, since Nimoy died and the whole little brouhaha of Shatner not being able to make his funeral.
Right.
There's a couple of things on that. One, he did, as he pointed out, he had a commitment to be somewhere else.
Yes. And Nimoy would have expected him to honor that.
Right. And you know, and frankly, Leonard's not going to care. So you have that, and you also have the fact that in some respects, Shatner is, I mean, they are the same age. And there's a mindset that a lot of folks get into once you reach a certain age and you start to lose your friends. You know, family, you know, you've lost a lot of family, you lose a lot of friends. Funerals don't necessarily have the same weight for a lot of folks.
Right.
You know, I had no issues with Bill Shatner not going to the funeral. His daughters went to the funeral.
Well, and the other thing that got pointed out, John Ordover, who edited pocketbooks, Star Trek novels. Right. We've had conversations before, and we've gone back and forth on some stuff, and we're connected on Facebook. He pointed out that a lot of people are not understanding Jewish custom, because you know Leonard Nimoy was an Orthodox Jew,
mm-hmm.
and I was reading Shatner's Jewish as well. I don't know if that's the case or not. I could have that wrong, but
I honestly don't know.
With Leonard's family being Jewish, the custom is to have the funeral and the burial within 24 to 48 hours of the death.
Mm-hmm.
After which, there's a period of observance called Shiva,
mm-hmm. right.
which is a week long, and that's basically, for all of us who are not Jewish, that would be what you'd consider the wake. That's when family and friends come and visit. They come over to the house and they, you know, they pay their respects and they do all that. And it's a week long thing where people visit the family.
Mm-hmm.
And the expectation among the Jewish culture, as I understand it, now I couldn't, you know, I'm, you know, third handing this.
Right.
But the expectation would be that Shatner would be at that. And that would be more important than him showing up to the actual funeral.
Well, and
Ordover made the point. He says it's always struck him as odd that people make a big deal of the funeral, because to him, in the Jewish culture, that's backwards. So everybody making the big you know blow up about Shatner not making the funeral. In the Jewish culture, the funeral is not the most important part. It's the Shiva that's the most important part, and we're in the middle of that now.
Well, and I think to some respect, part of it's the everybody likes to bag on Shatner.
I mean, well, there's that too, yeah.
And, you know, again, coming back to this unfairness to William Shatner, there is a, you know, is not everybody has to be the best of all possible people. Not every actor has to be the most friendly and cuddly and warm person, you know. Not everyone has to have the kind of embracing of their legacy that, say, George Takei has, or even Leonard did a later part of his life. Because remember, at one point, Leonard Nimoy really wanted nothing more but to be rid of Spock.
I am not Spock.
I am not Spock. The book he wrote, and of course, he's the one who said Spock has to die in Wrath of Khan. That was a contract. It was written in.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, Shatner has had at various points in his career a love-hate relationship with Star Trek and a love-hate relationship with the fans.
And with his fellow cast members.
And with his fellow cast members. But you know what? That's okay. We ascribe to these folks, for good or for ill, a lot of the character traits of the characters they play.
Yeah. And I think some of that is a challenge for the actors, because when they don't act like we expect them to,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, they get a lot of grief.
Oh, sure.
Because, well, why aren't you Captain Kirk? Mm-hmm. You know, all that. I remember, it was before Jimmy Doohan died. Shatner came out with his autobiography,
mm-hmm.
and he was talking about, you know, going to all of his cast members and, you know, talking to them about during the production and all this. And he said it was a very enlightening series of conversations that he had with his fellow cast members, mm-hmm. where he, yeah, and take this for what it's worth, he was sitting there saying, I didn't realize that I was rolling all over the cast. I was the star, and that was, you know, it was just the expectation that I did this and I, you know, act this way, and didn't realize, you know, that the rest of the crew was, you know, the rest of the cast was getting, you know, second fiddle and not getting a lot of material.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that is him, you know, being humble? How much of that is him just making a story? I don't know.
Right.
But it's interesting that after doing, because Doohan wouldn't have anything to do with him.
Right.
And after he after James Doohan died, Shatner came out with a series of novels that brought Kirk back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I specifically remember in one of those, Kirk and Scotty had a discussion. And it was almost too meta, because it was Scotty getting on to Kirk and just really laying into him for not caring about his crew. He was always the captain. He was always the cowboy. He was always the one that would go in where angels fear to tread,
mm-hmm.
and not really think anything of the careers of his crew members. And Kirk, of course, is, you know, he's got his comeuppance, and he's, you know, it's a humbling scene for him.
Sure.
And the words that are coming out of Kirk's mouth, you can almost imagine Shatner sitting there saying, I wish I could say this to Jimmy Doohan. Because it was very, very, very meta.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he's even said in interviews that he wishes he could make up with Doohan. Now, Takei is another thing altogether. But, you know, people, you're right, people question Shatner. They criticize him. They like to bag on him. But he and Leonard Nimoy were the best of friends.
Yeah, they were definitely, their friendship seems to have lasted the whole time.
Yeah, and has gotten stronger as they've gotten older. They've done other projects, and, you know, do the convention circuits and mm-hmm. all that. And you can definitely tell in their appearances together, they have a good time.
Yeah.
It's almost like Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen. Almost.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, the feeling of camaraderie that they have between the two.
Why isn't Ian McKellen played a Starfleet officer?
That's a good question.
Paramount, make that happen. Give me the Ian McKellen as the captain of the next starship.
That would be interesting.
I don't think I'd want to go up against a ship captained by Ian McKellen. I'm pretty sure they'd sit there and go, just kill them all. Like, wait, what? Yeah, so it's, I don't know, we can never know, we're never going to be able to know what was between those two guys. We saw a friendship, saw something, and I really hope it was as real as it appeared to be, because there is that sense of family that we have with, and of course it's illusionary, because we're over here, we're the viewer, we're the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But you got that sense. Star Trek had that effect on people. It had that power to be to connect you with the characters in a way that almost felt like family. You know, and so yes, that sense of the grandfather or the uncle, or right. You know, I mean, there then, and Leonard Nimoy seemed to have something that very few people. How many TV shows are on the air for 3 years and get movies made about them? I mean, there was something special about Star Trek. It hit people in a certain way. And how many people sit there and you have that kind of character? I mean, everybody knows who Spock is. There is no illusion. You know, you pick a country on the planet. I guarantee you that you show them a picture of Spock and they're going to sit there and go, that would be Spock right there
right.
in that photo you're holding. I mean, everybody knows Spock. There's something about that. There's something powerful about that. And, you know, considering Martin Landau was going to play that part.
Right. And oddly enough, Leonard Nimoy ended up replacing Martin Landau on Mission Impossible.
Exactly, yeah.
Not the same character.
Right.
But that same role, the disguise artist, mm-hmm. it became Leonard Nimoy's after Star Trek was done.
Right.
And he moved over to Mission Impossible because Martin Landau and Barbara Bain went on to Space 1999.
Well, it's interesting because you think about it, he did that a lot in his early career. He played a lot of ethnic characters in his early career.
Yeah.
In that Hollywood period where we're not actually going to cast someone who's Asian to play an Asian, we're going to find a white guy who looks mm-hmm. kind Asian.
Right.
And then we're going to give him some makeup. and 20 years later, everyone's going to sit there and go, oh, no, what are you doing? But yeah, so he did all, I mean, he kind of was, and especially as a bit player, as an extra and small parts, you were kind of a chameleon. So it's kind of interesting that one of his larger TV roles following Star Trek was to play something almost a fictionalized version of what a lot of actors end up going through in the early days of their career, especially yeah. then where you'd be on a TV show for 5 minutes. You know, I think he said that he was so excited about Star Trek because it was the first time in his career that he'd worked more than 2 weeks on anything.
Yeah. Well, and he and Shatner had worked together before on The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Right.
And what was it? He did a guest shot on The Lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
which is where Roddenberry found him.
Yeah, and that was a pretty critical appearance for him.
I think that one of the things that appeals to so many people about the Spock character is the fact that he was the outsider. And I was trying to explain this to my son the other day. Mm-hmm. He was like, why is this such a big deal? You know, his death as opposed to, you know, somebody else. I said, well, because it wasn't necessarily the fact that it was that he's a star, that he's a celebrity, he's famous. Okay, there's that. But the fact that Spock gave people an outsider to identify with.
He also gave us a way to look at ourselves from a point of view outside us. Which I think was really important, especially in the 60s and the 70s when culturally there were so many things going on. And you had the question, the civil rights, you had America emerging in many ways from yeah. the kind of illusion of everything was perfect that the 50s were.
Yeah, but I think more than that, it was, I don't fit in, that mm-hmm. crowd, the younger crowd, especially the teenagers.
Sure.
Which, our parents' generation would have been in that mm-hmm. realm.
Yeah.
You know, early college age, high school and stuff. And they're sitting there thinking, I don't fit in. Nobody understands me. And here's Spock, who's half human, so he doesn't fit into Earth. He's half Vulcan. He doesn't fit in there either.
Mm-hmm.
He's got no place outside of the place he makes for himself.
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, that resonated emotionally. Granted, I use the term loosely, given the fact that he was a Vulcan, but it was that fact that he was different.
Yeah,
and he gave that character gave you permission to be different.
Well, it gave you permission.
It was okay to not fit in.
Well, yeah, but I also think that, I agree 100%, but I also think it was also the way to look at ourselves Because, I mean, in many ways, Star Trek was supposed to be this idealized vision of us.
Right.
Right. And as we talked about in a fairly recent H2O episode.
Yes, we did.
Bright Futures.
Yeah.
But it also, you know, I think you'd have to have missed a lot of episodes of the original series to not recognize that there was a lot of social commentary in there. And that was a big...
And some of it was rather overt.
Oh, you saw it was very heavy-handed. The Planet of the Nazis. Omega Glory.
Let that be your last battlefield.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. If you
brain and brain. What is brain?
if you were to never take let be your last battlefield and Omega Glory, you would. The two of those, in many ways, are very brave episodes for the time.
Right.
But they are not subtle.
No,
in any way, shape, or form. Not.
Well, A Taste of Armageddon.
Oh yeah,
that one
true.
Wasn't none of them really.
But in many ways, that was the style of storytelling in the time. The fact that they got away with some of the stuff they got away with.
Yeah.
There's quite a few sources out there. Some really good books recently about what's that book?
These are the Voyages.
These are the Voyages. Thank you.
Yeah. Those are really
where you
good.
where you can read about the original intentions for some of these episodes. You realize how much.
And you read the studio notes, and you read the network notes, and see where all of this was coming from.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting. I've read Volume 1. I need to get Volume 2 and 3. I find it interesting that this myth that Star Trek was doing poorly in the ratings has gone on for so long. And it turns out, for most weeks it was on, it was number one, number two, top five every week. And, you know, based on ratings, NBC wouldn't have had any reason to pull it.
Right.
But the fact was... They didn't like Roddenberry. They didn't like the show. They didn't understand the show.
Mm-hmm.
The show cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they wanted to kill it.
Yeah. Well, it is personalities and it's money, and this is how entertainment is made. Mm. We've talked more than once about the fact that, you know, Hollywood is designed to make money.
Yeah.
And quality is not necessarily your guiding principle. And then you have someone who, like Roddenberry, who was, well, not the least abrasive human being, but you end up with this clash of power.
Yeah.
And you know, there were how many kind of, I mean, he was really looking at trying to have a creator owned show, really, is what he wanted.
Yeah, which is almost was unheard of at the time. But see, and then you stop me to think about, you know, the network interference, and you look at the original series, the original pilot, and the fact that the NBC wanted to get rid of the Spock character.
Yeah, well, you also look at the character in the original pilot, and you see a Spock who smiles,
and is
louder. I can't remember which book it was, one of the novel line, which incorporated that the cage exactly as it was on camera. So you see, Spock is actually remembering having that.
I think that was Vulcan's Glory.
It may have been where he was remembering being, because he felt comfortable with Pike.
Right.
He would let the guard down. He'd let the human side out more. And it was just like, we tend to gloss. You know, that episode is canon. But we all kind of gloss over, is that Spock smiling?
Yeah.
What happened here? You know, so.
He even does it in Where No Man Has Gone Before, the chess game.
Mm-hmm.
At the opening, you know, the opening scene.
But certainly less so than, say, in the cage or the menagerie for, depending on your.
And you mentioned Martin Landau. I wonder if Star Trek would have been as popular without Leonard Nimoy, and number two, would the Spock character have resonated with people if Nimoy had not been the one playing it?
Well, he put so much of himself into that. The neck pinch and the salute, all that stuff came out of him. I mean, that was him finding things in Jewish culture. In his own personal, just his idea at the moment, But it was all about him. It was his personal influence on the character.
Right.
And I think there's something about the way he carried himself. And no slouch to Martin Landau. I love Martin Landau as an actor. He's a
great
blast
actor.
To watch. But I think you really would have to question whether or not it would have had the same impact. It may have. It may have had an equal but different impact. But it couldn't have been the same because so much of that was Nimoy coming through.
Yeah.
And I think that if you went to... You'd lose something that he brought out in a way... There was somebody... There was an article I was reading about the illusions of the mind in fiction.
Right.
So basically, it's like, the emotional the unemotional character is they're incredibly effective, and how in the real world, real human beings who have their emotions damaged to the point that they no longer feel them are completely ineffective because our emotions actually become a reference point for the intellect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they use as examples a guy who had his emotions damaged, the part of his brain governing emotion damaged so badly that he was unable to play a game because without the emotional sense of winning or losing, the emotional impact that goes with that, he couldn't figure out the game. There was no reason for it to work.
No incentive.
And with
Nimoy, with his portrayal of Spock, you had the underlying, emotion. He even said it in Star Trek VI. Logic is the beginning of wisdom.
Right.
And had grown into that character. And of course, as the audience, we'd all grown into it with him.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding that logic alone, the intellect alone, is not enough to be a well-rounded person.
Right.
And I think that we caught Spock on the very beginning of that journey in the show, and he had a huge breakthrough, I guess you could call it, when they encountered V'ger,
mm-hmm.
when he first understood there's more to life than logic.
Well, I think Nimoy brought that, and I think it was really interesting for me because I am going back and watching some of the original. I have the director's cut of Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Oh, it's much better.
It's much better, and they go, folks, if you haven't picked this up, you should really really watch it. They finished the effects that weren't able to be finished, and they finished them in the style.
And they did a sound mix.
Oh, it's so good. It's so, yeah. That sense of this film just drags that a lot of people quite, in some respects, mm-hmm. quite justifiably had,
yeah.
isn't there. And the film is like the same length. There's not, I mean, it's like a couple minutes difference in time.
Yeah.
But it just pops. Anyway.
And it looks so much better.
Oh, it's so pretty. And usually
now I'm going to watch it again.
Well, usually when I say I've been known to say if something's pretty, not a compliment, this actually is. It's very pretty.
Yeah.
But I think you look at the original series and you look at that thing with Nimoy and you see a character who is the emotions are there, they're just controlled, okay?
Yeah.
And we hear about it, but we miss that point where he decided, he seemed to think that emotion had to be driven out. But even then, it's like in some respects, Spock misunderstood something that a lot of people seem to misunderstand because you catch it in some of the articles written about Nimoy's death is that the emotionless Mr. Spock, the emotionless Vulcans. It's like, well, no, the Vulcans aren't emotionless. The Vulcans, application of logic to their lives was because Vulcans were too emotional. The species let itself be ruled by its emotion,
right,
and became a danger to itself. So the logic is a way to help control and focus the emotion, and you got that with Leonard Nimoy, which is for a TV show. This is the 1960s. You look at a lot of the program, a lot of the storytelling in the 1960s. It's very episodic.
Yeah.
You're not looking for growth in characters. Unless there was a soap opera, And again, we're so used to now to story arcs.
Yeah. But still, even with soap operas, though, the characters didn't necessarily change very much.
Oh,
your circumstances did, but you know, and they got older.
Right.
But maybe switched the actor, but.
But you just didn't. You just don't see that. You see very rarely see the kind of episodic storytelling that we used to get then.
Yeah.
So you're not necessarily, but you got that. Maybe you're not necessarily looking at a character arc, but I think Nimoy took, if you watch those episodes, it's very clear that Nimoy was always thinking about Spock growing as a character when he was, you know, playing him.
Yeah. Well, and I think, too, it helped that he had such strong material from DC Fontana.
Oh, yeah.
Writing most of those scripts that revolved around the Vulcans, Amok Time.
Yeah.
Well, at least doing rewrites.
Right.
You know, Amok Time, the Enterprise incident.
Mm-hmm.
What was the other one? Journey to Babel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those that are very specifically centered around the Vulcan character and the Vulcan heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And then we even still, you know, we got some of it with the episode with Surak.
You
know,
this
mm-hmm. idea that Surak is, you know, the father of all we hold dear, and you've got this establishment of a Christ-like figure in the Vulcan mm-hmm. history. And even then, in that episode, they're talking about how savage the Vulcans were before they harnessed their emotions. It's mm-hmm. not, there's, it, you're right, I think this idea of the Vulcans lacking emotion has been a misconception that lives both in real world circumstances
right.
and inside the show, the show continuity.
Oh, you can
there
definitely
are a lot of people that think that about the Vulcans in
right.
stories too.
Well, and sometimes you stumble across this in some of the lesser Star Trek novels where you'll run into a Vulcan that's not Spock, and they're written so emotionless, and you're just like, you guys don't get it. How can you not get it?
Right.
It's a fundamental misunderstanding, and that is one thing that I will say about the first of the new movies, is that there were moments with the Vulcan characters. Ben Cross, who does immobile face
mm-hmm.
pretty well,
yeah.
that's
you still get a sense of something under the surface.
Well, and his two big scenes, one with young Spock,
mm-hmm.
And then after Amanda dies, where, you know, the emotion is there.
Yeah.
It's just he's holding it, and I thought that was, you know, there were unfortunately there's a lot of good moments in the new Star Trek movies. Unfortunately, there's films are made up of more than moments.
Right.
Those were moments that worked, and I think that, you know, at least in there they got it. And honestly, I think if Nimoy had not been on set. If Nimoy had not been a part of that first film the way he was, I don't know if they would have necessarily. But honestly, Ben Cross probably sat there and went and watched
Mark Leonard
play the part, and then watched Nimoy play the part and went, right, this is what I have to be.
Yep. Speaking of moments, we are going to take one and let you listen to a message from SuperheroStuff.com. Which is our
Someone
sponsor.
Does that better than you.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. And we're going to let you hear that. And we are going to refill coffee mugs, and we will continue our discussion of Leonard Nimoy and his impact on us personally, and pop culture in general, when H2O continues right after this.
You're listening to H2O on Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Okay, Tom, try it now.
SuperheroStuff.com.
One more time.
SuperheroStuff.com.
Well, we want them to visit SuperheroStuff.com. So maybe a little bigger.
SuperheroStuff.com.
There we go. That really gets in your head, doesn't it?
Hey everyone, Leslie Walker of Sci-Fi For Me here, just to give you a little reminder that our super smart crew members share their thoughts weekly on the DC shows Gotham, The Flash, and Arrow. Check out our podcast where we discuss these shows and story arcs, character development, plot twists, misses, and wins. Or if you'd rather check in for a quick recap read, we have you covered there as well. So join us for some DC-flavored morsels at scififorme.com, your portal to the science fiction multiverse.
Sci-Fi For Me Radio, transmitting by the power of Grayskull.
Brutal, savage, unprincipled, uncivilized, treacherous, in every way, splendid examples of Homo sapiens, the very flower of humanity. I found them quite refreshing.
Welcome back, folks.
It says a lot about us, doesn't it?
It does. Well, he had a lot of things to diplomacy. Diplomacy is the art of letting somebody else have your way.
Well, and you know, that goes back to what you had said earlier about Spock as a character being a way for us to take a look at ourselves and kind of poke at ourselves and hold the mirror up and see where our flaws are and what needs work and.
Well, yeah, like such. He was sort of the privilege. He had the privilege of being in the position to both. He had the privilege of being in the position, and it was a privilege for the character to be in that position because he could both be the outsider, but also be the outsider that we relate to.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is that again, and maybe not a bad thing to think about especially in this day and age, he did something that he was clearly the other.
Yeah.
And he made the other be someone that you cared about. And I think that there's a little thing to remind ourselves every now and again. Just because they're other, just because they're different, doesn't mean they're our enemy.
We don't have that character in any show right now, do we?
No, I don't really think we do. I think we've had some interesting things like you have shows like Homeland and things like that where they give you characters who are three-dimensional. So I mean, it's because it's really easy. I mean, there's no way I'm going to defend any of the various horrible people out there who are doing horrible things to, you know, there's some real, I don't want to get into politics.
No,
but in some respects, Star Trek was about politics in many ways, but the reality is that what some shows have been doing, and I think shows that are focusing on things like the war on terror are they spend time making their villains three-dimensional, because that's good storytelling. Even if you, because your villain has to have, your villain is their hero in their own mind, right?
Right.
So you have to, they have to, and the way for that works for an audience is you have to build that character so that their internal justification makes sense
to a point. Yeah.
Right. I think
Star Trek was more philosophy than politics.
I think they went hand in hand,
but, you know, from the standpoint of Idik, and everybody getting along on what, you know, let's all gather around the campfire and sing Kumbaya. And that actually turned out to be one of the problems that so many writers had with Star Trek is, you know, Roddenberry had this vision of utopia that doesn't take into account the fact that human beings are human beings.
Right.
And it's funny, James and I sat and watched Space Seed and Star Trek II over the weekend.
Right.
And even in Space Seed, you know, Khan is sitting there across the table from Kirk, and he says, it's amazing just how little man has changed in, you know, 200 years, 300 years. You know, all of this technology, and this is something we had talked about, you know, back in that discussion about, you know, positive futures.
Right.
And this idea of optimism being our guide instead of, you know, always assuming the worst and dystopian futures and whatnot. And Khan even points it out, you know, you've got all of this wonderful technology, all of this great stuff, but the people haven't changed. And I think that's one of the fundamental flaws of Roddenberry's approach in the whole idea of Star Trek. We are not going to get to a point, I don't think, where we're all going to get along. But it's interesting to see the example that Nimoy set, not as Spock, per se, but as himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at some of the stuff that he, you know, posted on Twitter and some of the things that he wrote in his books and all of the, you know, the way he lived his life, at least publicly,
it was
something, you know, something to be admired in you know, let's get along with everyone type of thing. And he did his best to live that philosophy of infinite diversity, infinite combinations,
yeah,
and make something really nice.
Well, in many ways, he was kind of the definition of what we mean when we say a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean like a, you know, you hear a gentleman of means or gentleman. No, there's a definition of gentleman, which is, you know, just a polite, pleasant, kind, respectful person.
Yes.
And I'm sure that he had plenty of his moments where he, you know, had anger and frustration and perhaps an unkind thing to say about somebody.
Probably when Shatner stole the bike.
Probably. Oh, I'm sure there were some choice words.
But and Shatner did address it. He says, "No, I don't have the bike."
Right.
He said that on Twitter over the weekend.
But I think the fact of the matter is he was always professional. It always seemed to be he was professional. And
he stood up for the other cast members. One of the stories that George Takei tells is when they were doing the animated pictures,
mm-hmm,
the animated series. They were hiring Shatner, Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, Majel Barrett, of course, Majel. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
Yeah.
And Leonard's like, "No, you're going to hire everybody or I'm not doing it." You know, because the whole point of Star Trek was this diverse cast.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to hire the diverse cast. That no, I'm not going to do it if you don't have them in there. And granted, Walter Koenig didn't get a whole lot to do, but he did get to write some episodes.
Right.
And you still had, you know, you had Nichelle Nichols and George Takei as part of the cast because Nimoy stood up for them,
right,
and said, "They don't do it, I don't do it." Which is ironic, given the fact that he didn't want to do Spock for the movies. You know, when they were, well, for phase two.
Right.
Well, you know, they're talking about phase two, and he didn't want to come back to be Spock.
But, you know, phase two was committing to another TV series. And for something that, at that point, his career had, he'd stepped away. I mean, you know, his career had gone on.
He was doing In Search Of at the time.
Well, I think he was doing In Search Of, and you know,
He was done with Mission Impossible.
Right, right.
He was doing In Search Of. You had Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Mm-hmm.
A Woman Called Golda was in the 80s,
yeah,
about that time. Yeah, you're right. He was diversifying and doing other things besides Spock. I wonder this for any actor like Christopher Reeve or, you know, Margot Kidder or Lee Majors or any, you know, Farrah Fawcett, any of these actors who play a character they get so closely identified with that they're locked into that. They get typecast.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly they can't do anything else.
Right.
And you got to wonder how much that eats at a person to get dragged back to that character over and over
you
again.
You see some people reacting. You know, they react very, very strongly to break that character. Christopher Reeve did Death Trap. And that was as far, well, in those days, that was pretty far from playing Superman.
Right.
I think the play works better on stage than on as a film. But quite frankly, I mean, but still, it was a chance to do something different. Now,
yeah,
he did Somewhere in Time around there, too. And
he did.
And
with that, Jane Seymour.
Which you just feel... No, you could see Clark Kent doing that. but I mean, you know, you get that kind of reaction where you don't want to feel trapped in a role, but at the same time, I think that you look at something what Nimoy did with bringing Spock back. You know, his deal was I'll bring Spock back, but I'm directing number four,
right?
And I think that gave him an opportunity to. And as much as, and I hate to say this, as much as I enjoy Four, it's one of the silliest. I mean, it's,
yeah.
And it's also actually
But it wasn't his first one to direct. He directed three. That was his deal to come back, was direct three. But I find it interesting, though, that on the day they're going to film Spock's death, everybody, you know, Harv Bennett was having second thoughts. Leonard Nimoy was having second thoughts. And he's sitting there thinking, okay, how do we give us an out? What's our out here? What's our exit strategy?
Right.
What's our hint that could get it back? And that's where the whole the Katra transfer and the remember and all of that scene came from, because it wasn't in the original script.
Right.
And Nimoy's written about it in his other autobiography, I Am Spock, talking about how much that character has just become a part of him personality-wise, and how the Vulcan philosophy and Spock's philosophy has influenced how he deals with people and how he treats other people. And he's just not ready to let it go yet. And he realizes this on the day that he's shooting the scene where he's supposed to die. Oh, wait, how do I get out of this?
Right.
You know? But you're right. I think that the success of that character did fuel a lot of opportunities for him that he would not otherwise have had, you know, from a directing standpoint, because from Star Trek III, and you're right, Star Trek IV was the silliest one, but it was a conscious change in the tone, because
hugely successful, and it really appealed to audiences. And I always feel bad about not liking it very much, because I think it's too silly for me.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's kind of at a tone that reminds me, just as Star Trek V reminded me in a negative way of the TV show, because Shatner directs films like it's a TV episode.
Right.
Okay. You look at that movie and you think to yourself, that's all of those are TV angles. That's all TV framing. That's TV pacing. And that's one of the reasons that movie, aside from the special effects and some other issues, with the script.
Yeah, Bran Farron should never be allowed to do any special effects for a movie again.
But at its core, it's directed like it's a TV episode, and that's a problem for the big screen. But the fourth one feels a lot like some of the lighter episodes. It feels a little tribble-ish.
Yeah.
And that's good, but at the same time, it is full of things that blatantly contradict the rest of the show. Like suddenly swearing is something they don't do, except we've heard them swear. We've heard them swear mildly. We've heard them 1960s swearing.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them, but yeah, I mean, it's like...
City on the Edge of Forever is the only place where it happened, I think.
Right. But I think that, there's... Nobody pulls that word and uses it for that kind of emotional power as if it's something they don't know how to use.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, money is established in the original TV show as a thing that exists.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's all these different things. It's all it's cute. It's funny. I laughed a lot, but on repeated viewings, I'd rather watch. I'd rather watch 1, 2, 3, and 6. And I try and Although there is a fan edit of number 5 that is cut, that is uses the original series music.
Oh yeah.
It's edited so that it's cut down. Actually, they trimmed out, I think they trimmed it almost down to an hour. And it's like every 15 minutes they find a place to make an edit at every 15 minutes, so it feels like it's a commercial break. And it flows so much better.
Yeah.
And it works so much better, and you're sitting there going, I think this kind of, but that's when you know. That's when you sit there. If you didn't realize that Shatner directs like a TV director, you sit there and go, "Oh,
yeah,
that's why it doesn't work." But it works so much better than this format.
But the thing about it is, though, with 4 being a comedy, that set up 3 Men and a Baby.
Oh yeah, it made it. Which it really showed people that
I think Nimoy did a really good job with that one.
Yeah, well, I think it showed people that he could do something, and then. I don't think at that point people were ever thinking of him about being a director. They weren't thinking about him doing anything. He was Spock.
Yeah. And he's still Spock.
Oh, yeah. But I think that it opened a door in a way that didn't necessarily give them nobody was looking at him that way. It was a way to expose people to a different side of him and a different talent.
He tells a story in I Am Spock. It's a director's story anecdote when he's directing The Good Mother with Diane Keaton. And they're in the courtroom, and she's up on the stand, and she has to do this really, really gut-wrenching, emotional, just falling apart monologue.
Right.
And they get all in there, and they rehearse, and they get set, and they shoot, and the whole thing is done. I mean, just, this is not something that you do over and over and over and over and over again. And after they're done, he realizes that the camera crew comes to him, and they realize that they have shot indoors with outdoor film. Mm. They had the wrong film loaded in the magazine, and it's all shot. There's nothing. There's none of it's usable. And Nimoy is telling the story. He just feels lower than dirt because now he's got to go back to Diane Keaton and say, you have to do that all over again. You have to go through the ringer all over again. And he ends up taking this, I don't know, this dozen roses or 20, you know, six dozen roses or what. I mean, he, you know, takes flowers to her and apologizes. Like, what director does that? You know, what director goes to your actor with that kind of display, that kind of outreach to say,
I think someone who understands someone who understands what he's asking that actor to do when it's that kind of powerful stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's, you know, there's,
I don't know that Michael Bay would do something like that.
I don't think Michael Bay.
I don't think very many directors nowadays would have that kind of sensibility.
You're not going to get someone like Michael Bay to direct the kind of film that you're going to require an actor to do that sort of thing.
Well, that's true, but you know, just any director.
I think
Well, J.J. Abrams might.
I think that the reality is that you know the for some actors who go and become directors and some other you know other roles, not just actors, obviously, you know somebody who works in craft services who works their way up to being a director is going to have a feeling for what goes on in the roles that, you know, is going to give them an empathy towards the people. I mean, Nimoy was an actor.
Yeah.
And he knows what he's asking for when he's asking someone to go to certain places. It's just another example of the fact that he was just a genuinely kind person. And he genuinely cared about the people that he was around. And I think that that's...
Shatner on his Twitter feed because he did that whole string of tweets because he wasn't at the funeral. Somebody was asking, was Nimoy anything like Spock in real life? And this goes to what you're saying here. He was serious, practical, but unlike Spock, very warm and loving.
Mm-hmm.
In another one, he says he was a great dad. He was a wonderful uncle to his daughters, to Shatner's daughters. You know, there is that sense that there was a much deeper personality that Leonard Nimoy had outside of Spock that a lot of us didn't get a whole lot of time to experience.
Well, in some respect, he was really, how much about his personal life can you talk?
Not a lot.
Yeah, and I think that he was good at keeping, a certain amount of distance between his personal life and his business. I think that he, you know, this is somebody who dealt with alcoholism.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people don't realize that. And he dealt with it. He went to rehab. I think that there's something that he found that balance between private and public, and I think that he let people in enough. He let the fans in enough to know that he cared. To know that he cared.
Right.
That he appreciated their caring for him. That he understood what it meant to be as important to them as Spock was, and to really represent that. But I also think that he found himself, he found that the way to have his life be his life without having to be under the spotlight. He also was of that generation of actor that wasn't getting 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week coverage. And I think that that worked to his favor too, because he didn't have, I think that it works too. Thankfully, a lot of actors have that opportunity to not be those people where you're constantly under a spotlight and a magnifying glass. And as much as, I hate to bring Justin Bieber up in any way, shape, or form, because not that he's a spoiled brat. He's kind of a spoiled brat. I'm not a fan of his music, so I don't even think about the kid. But the fact of the matter is that, look at him, or look, Shia LaBeouf or some of these other actors, they are...
Miley Cyrus.
They are constantly under a microscope. And some people are going to thrive under that kind of exposure, and some people are not.
I think George Takei is a good example of somebody who has taken it and said, okay, it's going to happen whether I like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just roll with it and do something with it. And Nimoy was fairly active on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he did a whole lot of other social media or anything, but he did the appearances at the conventions, and he did do the meet and greets and that sort of thing. But I think you're right. I think he was in that generation that did have a certain amount of privacy left.
Yeah.
Just simply because that's what they did. You didn't have any, in our generation, people our age or people like Jennifer Lawrence's age are going to have a completely different mentality about it because
their environment's different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because everybody's got the internet and, we're on the 24/7 news cycle and all access all the time. Mm-hmm. is the the way things are now.
Oh yeah.
As opposed to back then, where TV guide wants to do an interview, well, they'd have to come out and they'd have to conduct the interview
in
person.
Sure.
And you have to record it and transcribe it, and then it's write it
up.
Oh,
and you'd want to do it in person, because the phone interview would just be, your recording would be terrible. And
what do you say?
I think you look at some of this stuff. Because you have that kind of distance, because you have the fact that, this is Mr. Spock, and he really hasn't played Mr. Spock in a long time, and then so when he shows up in something like Fringe,
mm-hmm. or The Big Bang Theory,
the genre audience sits there and cheers because you weren't really expecting him. Even if you saw the blurb that says Leonard Nimoy is going to be appearing on Fringe, you're like,
yes,
and then he shows up and you're like,
there he is.
And you have that sense of, because it's a thing for the fans.
It's a community thing.
Yeah.
There's a sense of community.
J.J. Abrams asked him to be in Fringe because he's Spock.
Yeah.
And even if he's not playing Spock, and certainly William Bell was a very different character than Spock. In many ways, the villain.
Like him showing up in The Simpsons, even.
Yeah.
It's the moment for the fans.
Mm-hmm.
It's that we're in on the joke,
right?
Moment that I wonder if there are other. I don't think there are other genres that have that. You don't have those moments where somebody shows up in a show and you go, "Oh, that's." You recognize the actor, but you don't recognize the actor because of a particular role that they've played, like you do in science fiction.
Well,
because in science fiction,
no,
you have
actually,
it's harder. You have the Star Trek icons. You have the people that have been in all of these shows, and then they show up on other shows like Stargate,
mm-hmm.
or Fringe, or Threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Or the X-Files, or anything. There's that cross-pollination where the genre people show up in each other's shows. I mean, even directing, Jonathan mm-hmm. Frakes directing,
yeah.
or Roxanne Dawson, and now even, now you're into the second generation with Adam Nimoy being a director.
For things like Star Wars and Star Trek, these were game changers.
Yes.
Okay. And so I think that they have an ability to, and they had characters which made an impact on the culture. Say you go into horror, name your big horror icons. Freddy, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But
Jason.
But Robert Englund was under a lot of makeup.
Right.
Jason, who's a guy in a hockey mask.
Right.
Michael, who's a guy in a spray-painted William Shatner mask.
Leatherface.
Leatherface, who's a guy in a mask.
Yeah.
So if you're a fan of the films, you might know that underneath one of those masks is Kane Hodder. Or you might know that you might get excited about Robert Englund being in this movie or that movie, because you know that he's Jason. But for the average fan, mm-hmm. it doesn't have that kind of connection. And I think that's one of the things that horror directors, that's what they keep discovering with franchises,
yeah.
is that you don't have the kind of connection, you know. And but at the same time, you to some degree you do, because you have something like the Hellraiser films, where you have Doug Bradley who plays Pinhead. Mm-hmm. And Doug Bradley is not an old man, but he's getting older. I mean,
right.
And so when they, so the question is when you reboot the series, because they're rebooting the series,
like they do everything else.
Well, except Clive Barker's actually involved with the reboot.
Right.
He's actually part of it. The question is do you bring back Doug Bradley, because Doug Bradley is Pinhead, and
right.
but you don't see it in that kind of thing.
It's just like Sigourney Weaver. For Alien.
Sure.
You know, she's back for Alien 5.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's now thinking, how are they going to do that? You know, that raises ups the ante.
But you're also thinking that.
Blade Runner.
You're thinking that, but at the same time, you're going, yes!
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
But
And followed by, please don't screw it up.
Yeah, please don't screw it up. Well, and I'm less worried about Sigourney Weaver coming back than I am about Harrison Ford coming back, because I think there's a certain argument to be made
mm-hmm.
that there is absolutely zero reason for a Blade Runner sequel.
Right.
Now, the other reason for a Blade Runner sequel is because I want one.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
So
I was reading something the other day that I think it was on IO9, the idea that a Blade Runner sequel
ruins the ending for
the first one.
Yeah, I saw that. But you know what? Considering that you can't get the cast and the director to agree, the cast, the director, or the writer to agree
on what
the ending of the film is.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. We don't have that kind of connection to those individual actors playing those characters in most other genres.
No.
Maybe in the Western.
Yeah. Yeah, because Clint Eastwood or
John Wayne. And especially in the 60s, 50s and 60s mm-hmm. television, I think you could get some of that.
Yeah.
But you may see some of that becoming out of the superhero genre. Robert Downey Jr., Chris Evans.
Yeah.
Although
we still have to get to the point where we cross the line and answer the question as to whether or not this character is popular because of the actor, or the character is popular because of the character.
Right.
Because Batman, we've had several actors play Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Batman's been rebooted I don't know how many times now.
Sure.
And you've gotten past that point. But the Marvel stuff still has to cross that threshold where, okay, we've been doing this long enough, we have to replace an actor. And we haven't gotten to that point yet. So I'm really curious to see what's going to happen at that point when somebody else takes over as Tony Stark. Or
right.
does Tony Stark die or retire or go away and we never see Downey, we never see Stark again. But it's funny, we talk about, Sigourney Weaver coming back to Alien 5. I think she's another example, like Nimoy, of somebody who says, it's important that the franchise is done X way.
Right.
It's important that the franchise is done, that we go this direction, or that this is done with the characters. They have to be handled such and such and this and so. I don't know that you're going to have a whole lot of that with modern, I don't want to say modern, younger actors. Nimoy had, I don't know what it was, but, with Star Trek VI, he was very influential in how everything was done, from the story and, bringing Nicholas Meyer back
mm-hmm.
to direct and all of that. I don't know that you've got an actor, at least a genre actor, with that kind of clout, with that kind of reputation. Maybe Patrick Stewart?
Oh, I think.
But then I don't know. I don't know. Do we have a younger equivalent to Leonard Nimoy? Who is the next Nimoy?
That's a really good question. I have to think about that. Because I think part of it is what's changed in the way that our actors are in terms of how we look at them as personalities. You have the stuff in the 30s and 40s and or 50s where the studio system built stars.
Right.
Clark Gable. I'm going to make you a star. And that's what happened. They made you a star.
Exactly.
And they controlled you. They
Marilyn Monroe.
Your contract was for X number of films a year.
Mm-hmm.
You made those films whether they were crap or not.
Yeah.
Or and so you have some amazing, amazing actors in some terrible, terrible movies. There's a Humphrey Bogart horror film.
Is it really?
Yeah, it really is.
Oh, wow.
He's not the person you would cast as the mad scientist, but there he is.
Yeah.
Streaking his hair, and it's pretty cool. It's not a good film, but it's fun to watch. But you have the, they created those things. Television, the 1960s and 70s, and the 1960s and 70s movies were a different feeling too. So I think you kind of, everything started to shift. So in many ways, you don't have the same kind of stars now. Just because the model has changed, right?
Right.
I mean, the business has changed.
And the only stars, really, are attached to a franchise. They're stars because of a franchise.
Yeah. Well,
Scarlett Johansson, I don't think Scarlett Johansson would be as big, as popular a star as she is now without Black Widow.
Well, I would agree with you at the same time, but she was also recognized as actually being a very, very good actress. For other films. Now, I think that...
Right,
I think
but as far as...
Black Widow gave her exposure.
The sensation of Scarlett Johansson.
But again, we looked at...
It's much different than the actress.
Oh, certainly. I think that's... Some of this stuff is... You know, Harrison Ford's a really, really good actor. But
he's Harrison Ford.
But he's Harrison... But the thing is would any of us have known that if he hadn't been in Star Wars?
No. Because his career was over.
Pretty much. You know, we know that Mark Hamill is like an amazing voice actor. Would any of us have cared there was an amazing voiceover actor named Mark Hamill if he hadn't been Luke Skywalker?
No.
Because voice actors don't get the recognition they deserve, which is one issue.
Although that is getting better.
It is getting better.
I mean, Nimoy himself even had a voice acting career.
But the thing there is that's because the video game industry and the model has changed, and we know more about these people now than we used to. So I think that, I think back to the earlier question of would Star Trek have been the success it had been without the cast that it had? Without Nimoy being Spock. You could keep the exact same cast and put somebody else in Nimoy's part, even someone as good as Lando. And I don't think it would have worked.
No.
It wouldn't have been because he was the right person in the right place, and there's a reason Spock became the iconic figure that he was, and it was him.
Yep.
And I think that all of our stars get old. We all get older, except for us. We get younger every episode. Ha ha! And it's
only
always,
because I'm pulling the white hairs out.
There we
at
go.
This point.
And it's always a shame to lose these people.
Yeah.
Because you want more from them because they gave, and which is kind of unfair considering how much they actually gave us. And I think that there's that photo. There's that photo. That's made its way around the world, which shows the conference room on the Enterprise,
and it's actually from Space Seed.
Yeah,
with all four of them.
Yeah, I'll see all four of them there.
Kirk, Spock, Scotty, and Dr. McCoy.
And the next one is just Kirk there by himself.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw that, I got the catch in the throat.
Yeah.
Because you realize that you're reminded that everything ends.
Mm-hmm.
And you allow yourself to forget that a little bit when you lose DeForest Kelly and you sit there and go, oh, man.
Yeah.
And then you lose Jimmy Doohan and you go, oh, man. But we lost Spock.
Yep.
And Zachary Quinto is a fine actor. And I think his Spock in the new movies is okay.
But he's not Spock.
He's not Leonard Nimoy. He's a Spock. He's a Spock for a new generation, and that's fine.
But he's not Leonard Nimoy.
But he's not Leonard Nimoy.
When the news broke on Friday, one of the things that I kept circling back to was my own mortality. The older I get, and my parents as well, the older I get, the more mortal I feel.
Of course.
Yeah. You know, I'm past middle age, and it's one of those things.
Come on, 45 is the new 44.
yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. But, you know, I'm sitting there, and I'm at the point now where every day I wake up is another day that I have to fix whatever it is that I screwed up the day before. You know, oh, good, I get another day. I get a second chance. Every morning you wake up is another second chance, right?
Sure, sure.
And
that can be viewed as a positive as well as a negative.
It could, yes. Yeah. Well, and to me, it's a positive. If I wake up, because I die now, then, you know, we have issues. But the older you get, and then you know, celebrities passing away make you start thinking about people you know.
Sure.
That are either that age or your own age. Mm-hmm. I had a friend of mine a couple of years ago, at 43 years old, die of a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Completely out of the blue.
Right.
It's one of those things, it's just like, done, he's gone. And you get reminded, and you get a celebrity of the status of Leonard Nimoy, and you get reminded with a brick on your head that this is going to be over at some point.
Sure.
And you start to contemplate things, you know, how you live your life and how you treat people. And mm-hmm. you look at the example that Nimoy set, at least, you know, like we said, publicly,
mm-hmm.
you know, and
from all accounts privately.
Yeah. And, you know, he was a great friend. He was a great dad. He'd refound his faith,
mm-hmm.
you know, all of these different things, this example that he set for other people on how to live. And you want to do better, not necessarily because of Nimoy, but you get reminded it's going to end for you one of these days. You should probably do better.
Well, I think that any opportunity for looking at yourself and saying, let's make tomorrow better,
mm-hmm.
whatever the reason, is a good one. And I think that, unfortunately, because we are merely human and we have lives that we get focused on and all that fun stuff, we don't necessarily think about that all the time. And every now and again, we need that reminder. And it's unfortunate that it often comes with the death of someone.
Yeah.
To put things in perspective. But every now and again, we need to be shaken. And I think that if Nimoy was here in person, he'd shake you a little gently and say, now, come on.
Yeah.
You know, do better tomorrow. I think that if you have the opportunity to be regarded as highly as he was, if you know, I think there are worse things in the world to have somebody look at you and in the memory of you and say the kind of things that they're saying about Leonard Nimoy. If you did pretty well, people can sit there and say the kind of things that they're saying about Leonard.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss him. I'm going to miss the fact I was not expecting another Star Trek film with Leonard Nimoy in it, but the fact that I'm never going to get one.
Yeah.
Is
that's it's a gut punch.
Know, yeah. I think. I grew up with him.
When
I'll be
honest. When I was, I don't know, five or six years old,
mm-hmm.
my habit after, you know, coming home from school,
mm-hmm.
I'd turn on the TV and I'd flip some channels, you know, watch Superman,
sure.
you know, because it was on reruns. And I remember, I don't remember exactly how old I was, but I remember distinctly one day flipping through the channels, and of course that's back when you had the knob that you dial.
Oh yeah,
you
click, turn, click, 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 click.
And I stumbled across this TV show. And there were these two men standing in this brightly colored lit hallway. And the guy on the right's wearing a gold shirt, the guy mm-hmm. on the left's wearing a blue shirt, and the guy in the blue shirt had pointed ears.
Yeah.
And I thought, wait a minute, what is this? Leonard Nimoy was my entry point into science fiction. Mm-hmm. Into the entire genre was that image of Kirk and Spock standing there in the corridor of the Enterprise. That was the first, that was the moment. And it was Spock that drew me in as a character.
Sure.
And said, you know, I mean, I identify with both Kirk and Spock, depending on circumstances.
Sure.
But yeah, it was that moment of thought, oh, I'm intrigued. What is this?
And to think the studio thought he looked a little too satanic.
Yeah. Temptation comes in all forms.
I know. It's just, it's the end. It's the end of an era. It really is. It will be completely over when Shatner goes, and that's no hurry, Bill. Stick around as long as you can.
Right.
We.
I mean, even with Takei and Nichelle Nichols, Walter Koenig, that group. I mean, they'll still be around, but when Shatner goes,
it's the big three. I mean, let's face it. The reality is that even though it was completely unfair, in large part the perception was Kirk, right, Spock, McCoy.
And you know, most ensembles gravitate toward particular actors.
Yeah.
It works out that way.
But at the same time, this is kind of a thing
we could get all maudlin on this forever.
Wait till this starts to happen to the Star Wars cast.
Oh, and we're getting close.
Yeah. Hopefully, give a couple more decades out of these guys.
Well, I mean, we've already started to lose some of the crew.
No.
So, you know, all right.
On that happy note, folks, appreciate the folks who are around you. Try and live a good life.
Yeah.
Hug the ones you love.
Call your mother.
Call your mother.
Like J.K. Simmons says.
There we go.
Call your dad.
Aspire to be better every day. There we go.
Yep.
That's our takeaway.
That's your takeaway. All right. That's going to do it for us on this week's H2O. Tim Harvey.
My pleasure.
On behalf of everyone here at Sci-Fi for Me, I'm Jason Hunt. You can find us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, Pinterest, YouTube, Google+. On the podcast side of things, we are available on iTunes, Double Twist, OneCast, and Stitcher. And, of course, you can find the latest headlines over at scififorme.com. And we will be back next week with another edition of H2O. Thanks very much for listening, folks.
This has been a presentation of scififorme.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi for Me Radio.